You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Laura Blumenfeld is a national front-page feature writer for The Washington Post. She writes about national security, politics, and international affairs. And after she graduated from Harvard, Laura Blumenfeld moved to the Palestinian town of Tira to work as a community organizer for Interns for Peace. She speaks both Arabic and Hebrew. In fact, they've been chatting in Arabic tonight. I think Laura's very happy to have someone to speak Arabic with. I had the great pleasure of meeting Laura the year her book, Revenge, A Story of Hope, was published, and of writing about her for the LA Times. It's a remarkable book. It was a New York Times bestseller, and it's a very profound exploration of human responses to suffering and evil. And it's also a brave look at the price of violence, and it's a deep meditation on love and on hate. And I was so grateful that Laura could come here from her very busy life in Washington, D.C., to be our moderator tonight. Dr. Ezzeldine Aboulaish, whom you've come to hear also, is a Palestinian physician, born and raised in the Jabalia refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. He earned a medical degree in Cairo, a diploma in obstetrics and gynecology through a joint program of the Saudi Arabian Ministry of Health and the University of London, and a master's degree in public health at Harvard. He completed his residency in OBGYN at the Soroka Medical Center and served as a senior researcher at the Sheba Medical Center, both in Israel. All of my adult life, he writes, I've had one leg in Palestine and the other in Israel, an unusual stance in this region. He is now associate professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Toronto and the founder of the organization Daughters for Life, which you'll hear about more tonight. In December 2008, Israel launched an attack on Hamas fighters in Gaza, and in the early days of 2009, even when a ceasefire seemed in reach, a tank shell struck the apartment where Dr. Aboulaish and his family were sheltering, and when the smoke cleared, three of his children and a niece were dead. There's a term, lamad vovnik, it's a Yiddish term, a lovely Yiddish term, for one of the 36 humble righteous ones, or zadikim, mentioned in the Kabbalah of Jewish mysticism. And that's how book critic Jonathan Kirsch refers to Dr. Aboulaish in his recent review of I Shall Not Hate, his new book, in the Jewish Journal. He wrote, after this attack, like the lamad vovnik that he truly is, Dr. Aboulaish rejected yet another round of bloodshed. This book, I Shall Not Hate, writes Kirsch, is Dr. Aboulaish's earnest effort to repair not only the wounds that he and his family have suffered, but the troubled world in which Arabs and Israelis find themselves. To tell you the honest truth, when I first heard about Dr. Aboulaish's book, when it was first pitched to me for him to come here, my response was, I don't think I can deal with this story. And it was just too painful. And then I thought, but if he can speak about this story, then we must bear witness to his loss and to his dedication to peace and reconciliation. And so with that in mind, I'm going to begin tonight the same way if you were here a few weeks ago for Reverend Ed Bacon. He began the program with, and I think I need to do it as well, let's all take a breath and have a pause, and let that breath be an acknowledgement of something that Rabbi Abraham Heschel used to say, which is that in every moment something sacred is at stake. And let's pause and bring our minds and hearts and our collective beings around the truth that in this room tonight, there's something sacred at stake for all of us and for the world. So let's just take that pause. Thank you. And please welcome Laura Blumenfeld and Dr. Ezzeldine Aboulaish. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you so much, Ezzeldine, for agreeing to sit and talk and share your incredible journey with us. It's a story and a journey with many challenges and a lot of pain, but ultimately a story of hope. And that's why we're particularly so glad you're here. We're really here tonight to honor the memory of your three daughters and your niece, Bisan, who died at the age of 21, and Mayar, 15, Aya, 14, and Noor, who was only 17, your niece. I want to just read briefly to open a passage describing your feelings when you came back to your home, your destroyed home, for the first time, and also the place where your daughters were killed. From the moment we got home to Gaza, with smashed buildings, collapsed bridges, and rubble all around us, I realized that I had two options to choose from. I could take the path of darkness, or I could take the path of light. And what I would love to hear tonight, and all of us as we gather together, is how you chose that path, what your choice was, and how you came to make that choice. And to just begin, I wanted to start at the very beginning, when you were a little boy, and bring us back to your childhood home, the home you lived in. I know there was no electricity and no water, and even one banana. Tell us great details of your childhood home. Perhaps you could share that with us.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I am proud of being here. Proud of what did I achieve in my life. Proud of being a Palestinian child, a Palestinian refugee. But this is the hope. As a child who was raised and born in a refugee camp, from nothing, struggling for survival, just to live and to run your life, teeming poverty, deprivation. I remember when I used to go to the school just to be in the school, as we have no space in what is called home. It's one room in the camp to fit 8 children with their parents. The minimum needs of life are not there. But I look to that, and thanks to God, second to my mother and our parents, who were determined and learned one thing, that they lost everything, but they didn't lose hope in their children. And they have to invest in their children, especially in education. I have to succeed and to go to the school and to study from nothing. You have to succeed. And sometimes it was painful to me when my mother wanted me to be the first in the class and I have nothing. Sometimes you go to the school without a breakfast. And in the afternoon you have to work to help your family. It is not matching. But that's my mother that I love. And I know that she's doing that from good heart. She cares. I succeeded. So this life gave me the immunity. I felt immunized in life against those man-made sufferings. Because these are man-made. And that's what I can say to you. This is the hope. As they are man-made, you here, you can challenge those man-made sufferings in this world of not accepting it and to do something, to act, to change it. And that's what is needed. I may have the right to hate, but is it the right way? The antidote of hate and the revenge is success. And to move forward and to do good things, if I want to bring my daughters and other children in this world, justice, I must be healthy, free from this hate, this poison, so I can achieve their dreams and work for them. And that's what I was determined, and my children, to prove by action that the antidote of revenge and hate is success.
And this feeling of trying, wanting to succeed through education, I think is very, very interesting. You were, from the youngest age, getting up, going to school. But before you went to school, you actually got up at 3 in the morning. You were the oldest son in the family. You had extra responsibilities. Tell us a little bit about what were you doing, a little boy at age 7, getting up at 3 in the morning? Tell us.
When I go back to remember these days, as a child, to wake me up at 3 o'clock when they used in the camp to distribute milk and to collect that milk to sell it with a few piasters to help my family. I feel outraged about it, that this is injustice against children. Why do we bring them? Why do we induce this suffering to the children in this world? Being a refugee, poverty, I think it's the enemy.
And yet you
that the only thing I hate, not to blame someone because he is poor or who is his parents. And that's what do we need to prevent and to avoid. Now when I wake my children at 7 o'clock for their school, they don't want to wake up. But for me, at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, to stay in cold weather in line till 6 o'clock to get that milk and then to go to the school.
And yet an incredible thing came of that suffering, which seems to have happened, a pattern in your life. Your legs became arthritic, and it was hard for you to walk in the night to sell the milk and get a few piastres. And one day you just collapsed, and your family brought you to the hospital. What did you see in the hospital, and how did that affect you when you went to the hospital?
I succeeded. But how many millions of children failed? And we can prevent them. We can save them. I was exceptional. But what about millions, hundreds of millions in this world? That's what do we need to connect and to think of and to save their lives. It's not a matter of one person. We are connected as one family, which is the human family. And that's what do we need. Those children are the future, and they are our priority. When I went to the hospital, suffering from rheumatic arthritis, and I started to read the medical file, I dreamed to be a medical doctor. And I urge every one of you to dream, because no one can prevent us from dreaming. And that dreams are close to reality. But we need to have faith in it and to act. To be a medical doctor, it may be impossible for a Palestinian refugee in the camp. But look, it's a reality. And I learned from my life that nothing is impossible in life. The only impossible thing that I believe in is to return my daughters back. Anything in life, we can achieve. And that's what do we want to act and to do to achieve our plans.
I would love for you to share with us some of the details of, it wasn't just like, and then I studied and became a doctor. I mean, you overcame incredible hardships just to be able to even read a book at night. You didn't have electricity. The roof was leaking. Help us understand
the
conditions.
The camp, was early, late 50s and early 60s, water, you go outside to collect it in tanks. The washrooms are public ones, and the people are waiting in lines. When it is raining, this rain doesn't protect. And when we are sleeping, four or five, because we are attached back to back, so we can get some warmness, our bodies to give the heat to each other. When I see children, and still there is children in Palestine, in other places, with the same situation, I saw them in Afghanistan, in Kenya, in Uganda, everywhere. 50 years passed, and still the same situation. And this suffering is preventable, and we can avoid it. When I used to do my homework, and at that time we have to write with ink, a drop of the rain to come, and what I wrote, immediate it spread because it's ink. You need to repeat it again and to work hard or to sleep under the feet of my brothers. I never tasted to have a desk. Just on the ground, leaning and writing. The first clock I have at the age when I went to the university. Now my children, when I give them, it's completely different. In the holidays, the feast, where children must enjoy it, to buy the second-hand clothes, which are coming as donations for the Palestinian refugees, and to press them where? To put them under the mattress, where we sleep over them. But I look to that, of not accepting it, neither for me or for others. When I see any other child in the street, immediately it comes to my mind, my life. This child can achieve what did I achieve? And how can we help them to move forward and to rescue those children?
You say in your book, the weapon that I needed was not a rock or a gun, but an education. Who taught you that? Where did you learn that from? Was it your mother, your father? Was it something you read?
The Palestinian people in general, after they lost their land, and in particular the Palestinian mother, she is the hero. She was focused, determined. The strongest weapon is education, where we are educated and study to get a better job, to save our families, and to build and to have a better life. And that's my mother, as other mothers. The Palestinians used to save and to cut from their food to educate their sons and the children, to go to the university. When you ask any Palestinian father, he will say, I am wealthy. It's not by the real estate or the land. I have four buildings. I have four sons or children who are educated with PhD, with master, with education. That's what are the Palestinians learned and realized. And that's the strength of education. And we need to be educated.
And yet all along, I know you felt tremendous pressure to help support your family. And when you were 15, that led you to an interesting job in Ashkelon with a family, a Jewish family. I think that was the first summer that you lived away from home. tell us a little bit about that experience and how it changed your life.
It was in 1970s. And as I used, as most of the Palestinian children in the summer holidays, to plan to get some work, to earn some money to save, to help their families. It was the first time to go to Israel where I got a job in one of the villages to feed a chicken, a child, 14 or 15. I think now I feel it. It's injustice to take a child from his family for 40 days to suffer instead of enjoying the summer holidays. My children are planning their summer holiday. Where can they go? But for me, I counted the days, hour by hour, day by day. When can I go home? Away from my mother, my father. I came, and 1 week later, I found my father sick. And 1 week later, Ariel Sharon, he used to be the commander for the Gaza Strip, and they wanted to widen the streets. So how can they do that? To demolish the houses, what is called the houses in the camp. And one of those houses was ours. For me, it was a palace to protect us. And that's one of the things that, hey, I hate. I don't want anyone to suffer. The most painful thing, to be homeless.
That there was a terrible tension or a paradox that you talk about that was created by witnessing the destruction of your home, because you had lived with the family in Ashkelon, a Jewish Israeli family, and they had taken you in and they were warm to you and hospitable. And then you came back home to Gaza and you saw this other side of the Israelis. And tell us a little bit about the feelings that created inside of you to see the kind of two sides or the paradox.
As a medical doctor, I know white and the black. And the patient needs to be treated. And to be honest with the patient, this situation doesn't match. To treat a patient and then to smash him, it can't work together. The medical doctor always is saving lives, to treat, to help, and to be human, and just the human, in feelings and in actions. And that's what I think, the lesson that we need, to practice on the ground, to be just a human in all of our deeds and actions.
You talk about how you sort of were determined to try to understand or become a bridge between the communities. This was it very unusual for you, for a Palestinian boy from Gaza, to know Israelis, to live among them, or was that?
I learned from that, and I was willing to know. And through my practice in Israel, when I started in 1991, I learned from that our problem is lack of trust. And this comes of lack of communication, and that we are stereotyped. And we don't know each other. Through my practice, when I used to treat the Israeli woman and to ask me, from where are you? Of course, my face looks an Arab. They asked me from Haifa, from Akka, from this place. I wanted them to know that I am Palestinian from Gaza. And that we are similar. And that's my daughter, Bisan. When I sent her to Creativity for Peace Camp in Santa Fe in New Mexico at the age of 14, and when my friends called me, there is a camp, and it's for only girls. I said, I found it. It's girls. It's not for fun. They are serious. She came back to tell me, how similar are we? Jewish, Christians, Muslims, Druze, Bedouins. And that's what do we need. To do something so we can know each other. It's not to know by words from someone else. If I want to know, Laura, I have to deal with you.
I was so moved by what Bisan said, I wrote it down here. She said, we think as enemies, we live on opposite sides and never meet. But I feel we are all the same. We are all human beings. So you left for Cairo, you went to medical school, and you specialized in OBGYN. And you started reading a lot of papers about fertility, and you realized that, wow, there are Israeli doctors who are interested in the same subject. And so you reached out, and you contacted some of these Israeli doctors, and incredibly, they were responsive, and you became the first Palestinian doctor to work in an Israeli hospital, crossing over weekly, daily, over through the checkpoints. That's... Obviously, you were one of a kind. What were some of the challenges that you had to overcome? Logistics, prejudice, language barriers. Help people understand how unusual that was. A Palestinian doctor commuting from Gaza to an Israeli Jewish hospital to treat patients.
It was 1991 when I decided to come back to be close to my mother. At that time, I used to work in Saudi Arabia. And as I specialized in obstetrics and gynecology, I found in Gaza a huge number of infertile couples. You know, Gaza, now it's 1.5 million, living in 360 square kilometers. And some people, they think it's the most densely or fertile area. But I learned in area, there is a paradox. In areas where there is high fertility, there is high infertility. And it's a social problem for anyone, especially for the woman. I started to communicate with my colleagues, and it was the first intifada. And the first intifada started in the Jabalia refugee camp, where I lived. So I contacted them. And I was determined to challenge and to prove to them that we are similar and that the Palestinian doctor can't succeed as they are. Because the Israelis, they used to see the Palestinians as workers. But now they see him as a medical doctor. And that's what do we need to see the real face of the Palestinian person as a human being. I remember it when my dear friend, Mark Glazerman, introduced me to one of my colleagues to tell her, Zildin, he is a Palestinian doctor, but you don't know from where is he. He's from Jabalia refugee camp. She thought something is missing after she shaked my hand. But I was determined. I have to prove to them that I am a Palestinian doctor. I know medicine. I can treat patients. I overcame the language barriers, the checkpoints.
What happened one time you left your briefcase by mistake? You left it at a checkpoint. Tell us about.
Because the checkpoints, you have to pass through at that time by my car to get the permit for myself and for the car. And they have to inspect the car. So I took my suitcase out and kept it aside, and I am waiting for the soldier to inspect the car. And I am looking. I am late. I want to be in the morning meeting. Rushing. Once he finished, immediately I went to my car to start and lift my suitcase. When I arrived there, all of my documents are there. Where is it? I started to call them. And no one is answering. So I returned, and I learned that it was suspected, and they exploded it.
They blew up your briefcase.
They exploded.
With all your documents.
Yes. And it's still now, I am keeping it. So this is the suspicion. And instead of doing that, can we prevent and avoid to ask ourselves, why am I suspicious about you, Laura? And to tell me why, so we can help each other to avoid and to prevent it.
So you had pressure from the Israeli side, but some of your friends and Palestinian friends also questioned you. Why are you treating these Israelis?
I can say to you, the majority, always, as a medical doctor, we don't look for case reports or exceptional cases. We need the general public. Most of the Palestinians are proud of what I am doing and the Israeli colleagues. And that's what do we need, the majority, not to take, to look, to be always focused on exceptional cases. Exception is an exception. It's not the rule.
What did you say, though, to the people? You had some friends, which, you know, you talk about, who criticized you for helping deliver Jewish babies because they said, well, the baby is going to grow up and be a soldier and oppress us. What was your answer to those critics?
I have to understand them and to explain to them deeds and words are stronger than bullets. And why do we judge something about that to say this is a child, maybe one of the peace activists or the leaders who can change the situation or do good deeds, and health doesn't know barriers or borders. When we treat patients, we don't treat them according to their names, ethnicity, religion, background. Medicine doesn't know colors.
It's interesting. You talk a lot about medicine as a kind of methodology for peace, that medicine can bridge the divide. And you give a great example about if you ask an Israeli if he would want to share a room with a Palestinian, the answer would be no. But then what happens when they're sick?
And that's what do I say. Even I'm planning to do a study, to run a study. The Palestinians, they are stereotyped about the Israelis, and the Israelis, they think of Palestinians always of suicide bombers. And the Palestinians, they see the Israelis as soldiers with Apache, with tanks. What do we expect of them when they are vulnerable and sick and to be in the same room in the hospital? And I saw it. It's real in the hospitals. And this is the craziness. Look, we are fighting by night and engaging in medical activities during the day. They are sharing the rooms, the suffering, the stories. And sometimes they tell each other, oh, don't go for that doctor. The other is the best. And to express themselves. And they discover that they are human. Do we need to be vulnerable and sick to know that? Why not when we are healthy?
Would they share food or
jokes? Of course, they share
or
food, stories, jokes, life. They are living there with each other.
So medicine, you feel like, is the bridge.
Medicine, friendship. You know, that's my course, what I'm teaching, health. Even health and medicine can be engine for the peace at the individual level. If someone is healthy, he is in peace. If any one of us is sick, he is not in peace. Neither him nor his family. And that's what we need. And peace, it's not just what do we think, absence of war or conflict. Peace is more than that. To feel happy, safe, secure. And health is not to be healthy physically, but mentally, spiritually, socially. That's what do we need.
And tragically, in the fall of 2008, your wife became ill. And I know that you lost her very quickly, and it was a very, very painful time for your family. But you were kind of gathering together and pulling together when, in December of 2008, all of a sudden another war broke out. You could tell us about those days and the first moment when you heard the bombs falling.
this for 4 months period, and for me, number 16, I will never forget it. Because 16th of September 2008, 4:45 p.m., is the day when I lost my wife. And I was blessed from her with 6 lovely, beautiful daughters and 2 sons. Because I fully believe children, as I was raised, and the role of my mother, and even when I used to be a child, nightmares used to come to my mind. If I want to lose my father or my mother, see, I can sacrifice my father, but not my mother. Because the mother is the one who keeps, and she brings. And now I am burned by the fire of suffering that I lost my wife. What can I do for my children? But my daughter Bisan, with her wisdom, she said, you count. You can count on our support. You have to resume your work in Israel. But I felt I have to be with them. They can't be alone. And I started to search to find a place where I can work. And the end of the day, to be with my children. I have to see them every day. I can't tolerate to be away from them. And that's what I learned, and I can tell you. Take it. Don't say tomorrow. If you can do anything today, do it today. Spend as much as you can of your time with the people you love. You don't know if the next moment or the second moment is coming. Then the unexpected happened. When shilling from everywhere, 16th of January 2009, 4:45 p.m., when the first shell came, after I left my daughter's rooms, just seconds, I thought the shelling, because it was everywhere. I didn't think it's in my house.
There had been a 23-day assault that started in December. So, yeah,
I saw the dusk, the smoke, the cows. Is it my house? To go and to look inside the room. I don't want anyone to witness what I have seen. Where is Bisan? Mayar, Aya, Noor, Shada. They became parts, drowning in a pool of blood. Mayar, the beautiful girl, when I see her, where is her head? I want to see her face. I saw Shada with her eye on her cheek and fingers. But I can say, I am proud of being Muslim and a believer with deep faith that everything from God is for good. And the first message of support came from my son, Muhammad. He was 12 years old. He was a spoiled boy by his mother and his sisters. I started to think of him. He lost his mom, and now he lost 3 sisters. What is he going to do? To be crazy, extreme, to hate the world? But the message of support came from his mouth. When he looked at me while I was screaming and crying, to ask me, "Why are you screaming and crying? You must be happy." Happy for what? You must be happy. My sisters are happy there. They are with their mom. She asked for them. I said, "I don't need to worry about him. If this 12 years old boy is saying that, I have to move forward to be focused and save lives. And to save the life of my daughter Shada, niece Ghaida, and the brothers."
No, it was a terrible crisis. It was hard for you to get in contact with any kind of medical care, and you did an extraordinary thing. You had the sense of presence of mind to dial a friend of yours in Israel, Shlomi, who happened to be a TV anchor, and he was live on television.
It was God's mercy, and it was God's plan. I believe in that. At that time of shilling the house, I was supposed to be interviewed live by the Israeli TV, by Ushrat Kotler. And I was waiting for them to call me. So I called my friend Shlomi Eldar. And I didn't expect Shlomi to be in the studio there. But with this craziness, in the war, where innocent civilians, and there must be an action to stop it. So it was broadcasted live to open the eyes of the Israeli public, the Palestinians, the international community about the size of the tragedies there. Please stop it. And that's what satisfied me the second day when Ehud Olmert announced unilateral ceasefire. It saved others' lives. But why do we want to be killed in order to have ceasefire? Why not to prevent and save lives without any price to pay if we want to save others' lives?
What did Shlomi do? How was he able to help you? He was on television live. Did he get medical help, or how did you?
Because when I looked at my daughter's eye, and Shada, she is a unique girl. Because those girls, they never succeeded, less than 97%. That I was proud of. Believe me, if I have 100 daughters, I will be more than happy of them. She was studying day and night to be one of the first 10 in Palestine in the high school, on candles during the war and the shilling. The teachers were fighting to have them in their classes. I started to think of her. Is she going to be blind? Disabled? I don't want. I said to myself at that moment, why not to be killed and not to see her blind? To be with her daughters, with her sisters, but not to see her blind or disabled. And you know, for 3 weeks with this craziness, the number of killed people and casualties, 5,500 severely wounded, with the siege, with the suffering, Gaza can't cope with this number and this difficult cases. So I called Shlomi and I left him a message. And then he realized that there is a message coming. And he said to me later, I opened to listen. And I told them there is something wrong with Dr. Abu Laish. And he opened the speaker. And that's the human conscience where people can feel their humanity. He opened the speaker.
Live on television.
Live on TV. And he said to me, I felt it will be the last day for me in my work to be fired But I did it unconscious.
You can see it, by the way, on YouTube.
Unconscious.
You can watch it.
And then there is hope. When you ask me, there is hope and there is good in this world. The director general of the channel, he wrote him a paper telling him, keep the speaker open. Mm-hmm. And he kept it. And when I asked for help and to stop the shilling and to take my daughters and niece to the Palestinian hospital and then to transfer them to the hospital where I was just 2 days before the war. And that's what did they do. They saved Shada's eye. She lost the sight, but the eye is there. And they saved my niece's life, Ghaida, and the brothers. And that's what do we need, to save lives and to give, not to take.
You talk about in the hospital in the days after the attack, the assault, revenge was on the lips and in the minds of most people I talked to in the days after my daughters and niece were killed.
That's the people they thought I will be drowning in hate and revenge. Thanks God, no bad word came out of my mouth about revenge. But I was focused always, what can I do to save life and my children and others in the hospital? Because revenge and hatred will never lead to any way. And it will never help me. Because I have my children. If I want to get revenge, first of all, from whom? From my colleagues, my friends. And is it going to return my daughters back? That's the question. What is important for me is my daughters that I lost. If I got revenge from anyone, are they going to return? But what I am determined, the revenge in a positive way, to bring my daughters justice and to do good deeds for them and to keep their holy souls and the blood holy and noble. And with good deeds, with actions for other girls and other people in this world. That's what I am determined. And I said it. I swore to God at that moment and to my daughters not to relax or to rest. Because as a believer, I will meet them one day and to tell them, your souls remained holy. And I did my best to bring you justice by words and wisdom and just good words and good deeds.
This was a kind of positive revenge and a way to honor their memory, not a negative. What about the word forgiveness? I don't see that word in the book, and I'm just wondering, is it even something you think about?
Forgiveness.
Struggle with? Yeah.
It's important we use it. Our bodies is a trust. And we must take care of our bodies. And you must forgive your body from this hate and revenge to be clean. And I forgive my body. I forgive others from their bad deeds. But also forgiveness. When we define it with the academic terms, it's a mutual between two. Why always do we ask the victims to forgive? Why not to encourage the perpetrator to take responsibility and ask for forgiveness? We must start to change that. We need to help each other. to have a mutual, a dual action. That's what is needed. If we want in this world, forgiveness doesn't come from weakness. We need it to come from strength. That's what do we want. And at that moment, any one of us, if I did a mistake to you, and I have the courage to say, my dear Laura, sorry, I apologize, I did it, I will be valued highly in your eyes and respected and encourage you. That's what is needed, this world. Each of us to take responsibility about the action without blaming, from goodwill that we need to correct and to move forward and not to repeat the mistakes, because it's a human to err. But a mistake is a mistake if we repeat it. If we learned from those mistakes, it is not a mistake. But if it is the same mistake every day, we repeat it, it's a real mistake. And that's what do we need to encourage, forgiveness among every one of us, to take responsibility, to be connected, and to practice it.
Well, thank you so much. And I think at this point, we're going to open up to the audience. If anybody has any questions or comments. Let's see. I see one, and is there somebody on this side? In this? There, two. Okay, so we've got one, two.
Shall I start? Thank you very much, Doctor. My condolences for your loss and my admiration for your recovery. I just returned from Israel. And this is going to be a very brief statement before I ask my question. Peace and friendship and cooperation are not reported in the newspapers. Every day, Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post and the papers in Arabi are all about the negative things. So my question to you is, what do you think? I'm not talking about the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, but the general Israeli population. How do you think, how willing do you think they are to cooperate in establishing better relationships between Israel and Gaza, for example?
Thank you. And the relation is between Israel and the Palestinian people. Yes, Palestine. Gaza is part of the Palestinian Authority or the future Palestinian state. Gaza is part, and that's one of the things we need to learn. When we deal with things, we deal in a collective way. Not in a fragmented way. When I deal with patient to treat him, I don't focus on organs, on one organ. If he's coming, suffering from pain in the right hand, I look at the whole as a patient, as one unity. I think the Israeli public, inside their hearts and minds, there is good part of collaboration and living in collaboration with the Palestinians. But it needs action to be translated. Goodwill is good. Goodwill?
How is the translation
possible? To have justice. And I can say to you, to like for themselves and for the Palestinians, what do they like for each other? To put themselves in the shoe of the Palestinians. It's easy, you know, justice. How do we define justice? Someone, equality, this. Please, I can say to you, if you were there as a Palestinian, what do you like for your child? To like it for the Palestinian child, and we solve the problem. What do you need more? Freedom for all. Freedom for all. The Israeli public to be freed from the fear. And the Palestinian people to be freed from the occupation and to get their freedom. And this will help us to move forward.
Thank you.
Yes, Doctor. I want to thank you so much. You're a beautiful person. And I'm honored to be sitting in your presence. And you're very courageous. I'd like to ask you, when it comes to our foreign policy in this country, and the fact that we're so profound. How do you think this is going to play out if we continue our support for a government, not the people, but for a government that is so oppressive?
The world was hopeful about the new administration in the States, and still we are not allowed to lose hope. And they can support the current Israeli government for the good deeds, if they are doing good deeds. But I think to support them for everything black and white is not harmful to the Israeli public and the Israeli government. It's harmful to the Palestinians also. And they want to trap and to drag the Palestinians to the violence. And we have a good saying in Arabic, support your brother for the good and bad deeds. The good, we know how can I support, to encourage him to do more. But how can I support him for the bad deeds he's doing? Prevent him from doing that. In that way, you save him. We need to open the eyes of the current Israeli government. This is not the right way. You must change and adopt new policies and to be serious about the peace process. And this, I think, the role of the current American administration and the international world and the American Jewish people here. They must practice it. All of us, as Palestinians and Israelis, we are living and riding the same boat. And any harm induced will affect all of us. So if we want to save one, we need to save all together. Any risk will affect all of us. So that's the case. The future and the safety and security of the Israelis is linked to the safety, security, and the future and dignity of the Palestinians. That's the guarantee for a sustainable future for both.
Thank you. One, two.
Going back to the concept of forgiveness, what was the reaction of the Israeli military after what happened? And do you feel seriously that they were earnest and serious in asking for your forgiveness?
This is one session about it. I remember after what happened, I know who shelled the house. But instead of having the moral courage and to admit responsibility and to take it, sometimes the fear of the consequences, they started to justify and to confuse the public.
What did they say? What was their
justification? The first day, they said there were snipers at the roof of the house. And it's my house. And my brother's house, the fifth floor. I said, and that's, please, you know what? When you listen to something from the media, think of it. Don't take it for granted. They are not angels. They are not holy. They said, sniper. I said, okay, if they were snipers and they saw them, why they didn't shell the roof of the house? And if the first shell misled its way, why two shells? And it's only one room, the daughter's room. And for every story, there is one scenario. The second day, they said there were armed people inside the house. Militants. I said there were militants. My daughters were armed with love, with hope, with education. And it's not enough. The third scenario, and the people are believing them. They are handling those lies. to spread it. There were firing from the surrounding. And the most painful scenario, when they said they took shrapnels from my niece's wound and they examined it and they found it was from Qassam rockets. It's painful. It's unethical. It's enough. Why not? It took 1 month to investigate. To investigate what? To admit and to take, to say, we shelled the house. And that's what do we need, to have the moral courage. First of all, to be honest with ourselves. Not with you. I have to be honest with myself.
Now, there's something last week I read in the news. You're launching an investigation or suing?
No,
or
not what, investigation.
What are you doing? You took some legal action.
Because within 2 years, and they used to come to the hospital where my daughter, niece, and the brother, the Israeli officials, they used to come to visit the Israeli soldiers who were wounded. And I am just a few feet from them. And no one came to say, sorry, Israeli. I said, never mind, but the Israeli public, the people who used to come, who felt their humanity, Jewish, Christians, Bedouins, Druze, from all over, from the Palestinian Authority who used to come to feel it, they showed the passion and the support. I started to, because I have to bring my daughter's justice, and to wake up those officials. Through my colleagues and the friends, as the foundation that we have, I have established, Daughters for Life, which will be for girls and women, for health and education, in the Middle East, including Israel. I asked for apology and the compensation, and I told them clearly, any compensation that comes to go for the foundation, to help other girls, and to say that it's time to give my daughter's blood, did something for others. But I learned they only just deaf ears, and to say it's collateral damage. Daughters are a human being, they are not objects. To say collateral damage, and to say there is a statute of limitation. Human life and beloved ones have no statute of limitation. My daughters will stay in my memory and your life as a human being as long as I am breathing. And a human being is breathing. There is no statute of limitation. So when they left, no alternative in front of me. After I used every peaceful way, Amir Peretz, Avishai Braverman, many of them, they started to mediate, but no positive answer. I have no way just to file the lawsuit.
So you filed the lawsuit against the military?
Against, you know, my lawyer there, he submitted it.
Yes.
I have a few comments. In 1975, I was studying OBGYN in Dublin, Ireland, and there was a Palestinian doctor studying the same subject with me. And he was working in Jerusalem with the Jews. And he was, when I asked him about their treatment, how they treat him because he's Palestinian, he said very nice and very good things about them. And he said that they treat me very well as they treat each other. And I remember last year I was in Jordan and in the hotel I was sitting in the reception and a bus came with women and men, Palestinian tourists visiting Jordan, and they reside in the same hotel that I was in. And they came in the reception, and in between them, they sit beside me, and in With them, there was a girl like around 10 years old, and I asked her about her name and everything, and I said, "Do you see Jews in between you?" She said that they are our neighbors, and we love each other, and we share food and many things in between them. There is nothing in between them, in between us. I said, then I started to communicate with their parents, the parents of the child. I said, then, what's all this hatred and killing that I see in the TV? She said, they said it's politics, it's not between us. We people like each other. We don't discriminate, we love each other. So this is my comment.
And I agree with you. And that's what do I think, what do we need? We need to humanize, not to politicize. And our enemies, as Palestinians and Israelis, which can be reflected on other nations, the ignorance of each other, the arrogance, and the greed. And these are three factors, I think, to change them, each of us, this is change. And the change can't be achieved if we didn't start the change within each of us. There is ayah in Quran says, God will never change what is in people till they change what is in their hearts, souls, and minds. Please, each of us to start to look inside himself and then to look at the other. Don't blame the other before you look inside. See yourself in the mirror before blaming others.
Thank you.
First, please accept my condolences for your loss, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant you a reward for your patience and perseverance. My question to you, as a Palestinian from Gaza who worked in Israel, and someone who talks about hope and peace, where do you see this this hope, and how do you envision this peace while the Israeli government is making it almost impossible for the two-state solution, and the existing extremist government in Israel is making it almost impossible for a one-state solution? So how do you see the hope in peace, and how do you envision this kind of peace?
We are meeting here because of hope. If we lose hope, there is no life. As long as we are living, there is hope. And as a medical doctor, we are not allowed to lose hope. As long as the patient is still alive, though in a critical situation. And in our life, we faced many cases. In our terms, we say it's hopeless, but we treated, we did our best, and we saved the life of the patient, and many of them are living among us. We saw that, and I can say to you the hope. Nothing is impossible. It may be difficult, but it is not impossible at all. In the States, if I came to any one of you 4 years ago, and to tell you, someone told me the president of the States will be a black guy called Barack Hussein Obama. What are you going to say? No, impossible. But who is the president now? He was determined, and he worked. I am sure he planned it, and he worked for it, and he achieved it. The future of the relationship, when you ask me how do I imagine it, first of all, we need to stabilize the patient. And when someone asks me, you know, what do we want, one state or two-state solution? It's a theoretical question now with the difficult situation that we are facing there. And it looks for me, being obstetrician and gynecologist, like a woman coming in labor, screaming of labor pains, and I approach her to ask her, what do you want? the baby to be, a baby boy or girl, afterwards, where are you going to send him, to which school, which university, what will be the name? I think she will kick me and to say, deliver the baby, save me, and then we will see. So it's a matter of saving lives and the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Thank you. And now for our last question.
First of all, I'm absolutely enthralled by your stance and your courage despite everything that you have faced in your life. My question is slightly of the personal nature, that how much the faith played a role in overcoming your difficulties, and to generalize a bit, how can we extend the platform of faith to resolve these issues that we have?
The faith is vital. I fully believe in that, and it helped me a lot. And faith can play a positive role, because I believe religions came to save humanity from the days of darkness to the days of light, from slavery to freedom. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So faith helped me a lot. And someone, we need to learn the religions, that there is a common ground between religions and faiths, and they are good, all of religions. But it's our responsibility when someone is doing something wrong, not to attribute it to the religion. Attribute the deeds to the person himself. Izzeldin, as a Muslim, if I did something wrong, not to say Islam is doing that, or Laura, as a Jewish, to say Judaism is doing that. We must separate. Religions are beautiful if we took the good, and they are good religions, and to think of saving humanity. And that religion is between you and God. We are not coming to judge each other. The judge between each other is how do we respect and deal with each other. Religion is how we deal and to help others. So faith, it's important to have faith for anything, any religion that you believe in. Because once you have faith, it gives you energy to do something and to move forward.
May I say one more?
Yes.
I am a Serbian, and I was in many battles among the people, and I saw the dead people, and I saw the wounded people. And I have a conclusion that those people who created the war are psychopaths. All of them are psychopaths.
Thank you. And to conclude our evening, we're going to ask Izzeldin to read a very special poem. I think we're actually even over time right now, but maybe if you want to talk privately afterward, there'll be some time. We're going to have a book signing. But before we break, we're going to hear a very special poem from the doctor. Thank you.
This is a poem which was written by an El Harbaz. She's an Israeli Jewish woman who knew my daughters for the Creativity for Peace Camp. And it's for every one of us, especially men, to think of it and to adopt it and to work for it. Where love resides, in memory of Bisan. I long to touch you, Bisan, one more time, to hug you, to tell you how sorry I am that your mom died But now, you too are gone. Your smiling face, your gentle way, your softness, your non-judgmental words, your pain for your people, your way of life, your dreams, aspirations, and your hope for peace. Just days before the war, I spoke with your dad. He gave me your phone number. It's still in my car. Every day I glance at the number, seeing your name, Bisan. I wish I had spoken with you more, but I didn't have the guts. I spoke with you 3 days before you died. I told you that I am praying for your safety. My prayers were not heard. Through the shelling, the bombing, the Qassams, the smoke, I feel I have been betrayed by God, by my country, by the cruelty of humanity, by the warmongers, by those who think violence is the solution. And with all of this, I have been given a gift, to have spent 6 weeks with Shada, Azzeddin, and Ghaida. I heard no words of revenge, no hatred. I heard the deep belief that peace is possible, even with this enormous loss. I have been strengthened from their strength. I am more determined from their determination. I am more at peace from their peacefulness. Bisan, forgive me for not being able to save you from my own people. Forgive me for giving you hope that peace is possible, and then taking that dream from you. You will always be my symbol of hope, peace, and mostly gentleness. Your dad shared the dream with me days after you died. He came into a room full of men, and there you were, sitting amongst them. He asked you, "Why are you sitting here, Bisan? You know it is not acceptable in our society." You answered, "All is fine now, Dad. I am happy and well. I can be here now among the men where I am needed. May no other woman need to die in order to be able to influence the men as you have, Bisan. May we women be heard and heeded. And may the men in this world get the chance to know from deep within their hearts, this is where the answer lies, in their hearts, where love resides." And that's what do we need, to open our hearts, minds, and ears to each other. And I fully believe at that moment, the hope will be enlarged and the brighter future for us and the future generations will be a positive one. Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.